Hey guys, this is Nikhil.
And this is Nick.
And welcome back to Infinite Knots.
Episode number 14, coming at you after, well, a fairly long absence. So it's been quiet for a bit, but we are back at it and ready to roll. So how are you doing this morning, Nikhil?
I'm okay. I've been doing this thing for the past 2 days where I just haven't been drinking coffee.
Really? How's that been going?
No caffeine detox. I don't know. It's been going good. I mean, I did feel a little sluggish at first. In fact, I still do feel a little sluggish, but that's okay because I'm just, you know, running with it. And it's I don't know, something that I should probably be doing every now and then.
Yeah, a little cleansing run. I think today is day three for me without coffee. Yesterday was unintentional. This is day four. Because Tuesday, I made my mug of coffee to go to class, set it down by the door, walked outside, got on the bus, and realized, crap, coffee is at home. So, which is disappointing because I made an entire mug of Slate's Aricha, which is one of the best coffees I've ever had. And so it was kind of like, you know, it felt sad to me. It felt like I had done justice to that coffee, so... Yeah, so I haven't felt really any... I've been having coffee in the afternoons, but not in the mornings, and it's been going fine.
Yeah, I think coffee in the afternoon is better than coffee in the morning a lot of the time.
Yeah.
I'm just so strung out in the morning most days. Like, I don't need more stimulation when I wake up.
See, I honestly don't really feel a difference between having coffee or not. And if I have coffee in the afternoon, it's more of... It's not because I'm getting, like, a headache or... like starting to fall asleep. It's more of like the ritual, like, okay, I'm going to go to a coffee shop and work on something or meet a friend or something like that.
Yeah, it's a good way to relax a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely.
In the middle of the day. One thing I also started to do was run. I've been running now.
Really?
Yeah, and I don't run at all, or I haven't been in the past. And I just, for some reason, you know, every friend I have who runs, they've always told me that to do long distance running, there will come a point when you're running that you feel super tired and you just don't want to run anymore. But if you power through it, you reach like this nice kind of medium, like this rhythm, and then you can just keep hammering on that rhythm forever.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't believe them. And then 2 days ago, I just tried it. I was in a lot of pain while running, and I just said, you know what, I'm just going to power through it. And after about 10 minutes, I was in this nice rhythm, and I just did not have to stop at all. And I ran a good 3 miles. In a row straight, which is a lot more than I've done in the past few years. So
that's awesome. Yeah. So they talk about the quote unquote the runner's high, where all of a sudden you feel amazing, you can just like run forever.
Yeah, that could be it. Might exactly be what that was.
I have never had a runner's high. I had one. There was one night where I went out late one evening to go run and did my route and felt like, oh, I could run. I could go and do some more. So I added a little bit on, not a lot, but I added a little bit onto it. But yeah, I've never experienced that. But I ran in middle school, high school, and then ran like cross country, ran on and off through college, and then really haven't in a number of years. So
one thing that I really found though is that even, you know, I lift weights every now and then, but whenever I go running nowadays, I found that I get the second wind for my work. Like, you know, I work and then I go running and then I come back and I can work again with a fresh mind. And that's valuable. So what I've been thinking about doing here in South Lake Union is bringing some running clothes. And, that, you know, when I hit that 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock slump, instead of grabbing coffee, I'll just go out and go for a nice long run.
There you
come
go.
Back, take a shower.
You can use the commuter shower downstairs.
Exactly.
To store all your stuff. So. Yeah, no, that's a great idea. Yeah, running, there are very few things that are as healthy for you as running. They're just the holistic motion, being outside, being like the natural rhythm, the natural body mechanics of running, the mental perspective of it. It just really is one of the healthiest things that you can do for you. Arguably, the other one is swimming.
Mm-hmm.
Where you take a lot of that stuff and then you take all the pressure off your joints. But if you're running correctly, where you're not just... See, the problem is most people jog. So when their foot hits the ground, because they're moving, they're like doing that slow, small steps. When their foot hits the ground, their leg is almost perfectly perpendicular. So they just transmit all the force up their leg. And that is not good for your joints. But when you're running, when you hit the ground, you're supposed to be hitting it at an off angle and pushing. Mm-hmm. So you're transmitting that force to continue to propel you. And so it takes a lot of the pressure off your knees.
You know,
most people don't. They run too slow,
though. Your comment about swimming, I believe that, too. I know my mom started to get knee problems because she was running so much. And her doctor was just like, go swimming. And problem solved. But it makes me wonder if, like, you know, runners get a runner's high. Do swimmers get a swimmer's high where that's you can just swim forever?
I'll have to ask. I have some friends that swim fairly regularly, and so we'll have to see. I'll have to ask them about that. That's a really good question.
And I wonder how you get one of those quote unquote highs at all. And I wonder if we can do it for like work or programming.
I think you do, right? You like slip into those you know, quote unquote like magic moments where you're just like everything is working. You're just powering through. You're getting stuff done. You're not writing a bunch of dumb. To me, I know it when I've hit that mode when I'm typing and I don't have to keep correcting myself. Where I'm not like, you know, you're typing variable names. Variable names are kind of odd. But when I'm typing those out, I'm not making a whole bunch of typos. That's when I know that I'm in the zone.
Okay. I never know when I'm in the zone. If I'm in the zone, I'm in the zone. And it's completely subconscious.
Yeah, I think that's what makes them so beneficial when you have them, is that there are these few times where all of a sudden everything just kind of like clicks in and you're moving.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's that elusiveness that is really appealing, I think. Cool. So what else have you been working on the last couple of weeks?
Oh, man, I've been doing some deep digging into metabolic and pathway databases.
Was it Reactome?
Reactome, CAG, Wikipads, or Wiki Pathways, Ingenuity, a lot of these. And it's been interesting. What I've found so far is that there's almost no consistency between any of them, which makes a lot of biology really hard because you can't reproduce stuff. So you're like, what's going on? And on top of that, I've been learning a lot of network methods, network-based analysis methods to basically solve a lot of problems that are kind of tough and interesting. Like, so basically, if you have a bunch of different, so you have DNA data, RNA data, protein data, phenotype data, functional data, and in the past we used to connect them through like MySQL tables,
mm-hmm.
which is a pain in the ass. But if we use a network, you can have all that data in one place and you can run a lot of cool methods on them, like shortest path methods from phenotype to DNA, like SNP. What's the shortest path?
Yeah.
Or like, what is a big hub? Like, what gene is like has the highest betweenness value, mm-hmm. which means that it's the shortest path for a bunch of other phenotypes and DNA and RNA nodes. So that might be a good drug target.
Yeah. Now, does a shortest path, does that indicate clinical or biological significance?
In certain contexts, it does. It depends on what you're trying to answer and what you're trying to do. But, if you think of the whole notion of maximum parsimony or Occam's razor,
mm-hmm.
Where the simplest answer is most often correct.
Yeah.
In that case, yes, because the shortest path is the pathway of least resistance from phenotype to some kind of DNA mutation.
Interesting. Cool. And as you've been digging through this, is there anything interesting that you've learned or it's popped out?
Just more about, you know, so far it's been more of things about databases. Like one database, I'm not going to say which yet, about half the genes that I found didn't even exist anymore.
What does that mean?
It means that the genes that they claim that they used to call their pathways, they were later pulled off of NCBI for being like a different gene or just not existing. So they've been deprecated.
Wow.
So, and it's been a long time since these databases have been curated, right? So either they don't know about it or they know about it and they just don't want to fix it or they don't care enough to fix it. It's an interesting thing.
Interesting, yeah. Yeah, this seems like, because how many elements or records or whatever or genes would be in one of these databases?
Well, in terms of genes, I would say maybe 5,000. Or so.
Okay.
In terms of records, man, there's going to be a whole bunch. I mean, a pathway, in a sense, is is basically a human construct.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, in terms of networks, it's just like a subnetwork in your big hairball network. It's just a subnetwork. So, and that's, it's just been, you know, associated with cancer or associated with glycolysis or something,
mm-hmm.
And they call a function. And in that sense, it's completely arbitrary. So, you know, I think maybe you could start your own pathway database.
Probably could, yeah. Maybe we call it NickBase? I don't know.
NickBase, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, the whole, and all these databases are curated by experts, quote unquote.
Mm-hmm.
And they all have their own reasons for calling a certain pathway, to be associated with a certain function. And we can't reproduce that sometimes, which makes it hard to believe it.
Yeah.
But you have no other way of, you know, you have nobody else's word to take. They're the expert, so.
So if you were to fix this problem, if somebody was to give you a bunch of grant money, say, Nikhil, fix this, what steps or approaches would you take to do that?
Oh, I would start from scratch. I would basically, a lot of this data was gathered over the course
of... You would start from scratch. That's always your first answer, just like, start over.
Well, you want to know why. It's because a lot of the technology that we have now, in bioinformatics at least, DNA sequencing, RNA sequencing, it's all gotten to be dirt cheap.
Mm-hmm.
It's very high throughput. You get a lot of data for very little money. And it's fast. So you can redo a lot of the stuff and get a much higher quality output and then re-annotate those and then re-categorize them into pathways. And that would at least give you high quality data to start off with. And from there, you can do a bunch of other studies to figure out what the functions could be, so on and so forth. I think it's you know, it's coming. Like that whole step of redoing these databases, I'm not the first person to suggest it. I'm certain. And over the course of the next 20 years, when technology gets even better and faster and cheaper, it's just going to be, you know, it's going to take a few months to redo all of them.
Yeah.
So why not?
So just redoing them, though, doesn't really solve the problem that you have brought up, which is inconsistent naming, opaque methodology for assigning function and categorizing and stuff. So how do you start to solve that type of problem?
Well, the first thing it solves is reproducibility.
Okay.
So at least if you get some data, you can reproduce it. And it's not going to be like...
But does it, though? But we've shown over and over again that even if you start with the same data, like all the papers, excuse me, that publish all their data and stuff with them, like what, 30% of them are reproducible?
Well, only because they're using some kind of crazy method, which is a new method that they developed for the problem at hand. And it's not reproducible because they don't share their code exactly. They share their algorithm, right? Which might not be exactly the same as what their code is. So there's a little – I mean, it's not completely 100% reproducible, but it's reproducible enough that you can get the right answer. And that's kind of where we stand right now. But I think in the future, we can get it to be 100% reproducible. And in terms of naming conventions and stuff, you know, I hate to say it, but standardization is the answer to that. And we've done that over and over and over and over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have several different standards for naming SNPs, for naming genes. And it's not just a USA thing. It's like we have the European and Asian databases too, and they've combined all of them together. And, you know, we might say one gene doesn't exist, and somebody else might say, well, hey, it does exist according to us, and there's all these discrepancies in that way. On one hand, it helps you check yourself. So you go, okay, wait a second, maybe I made a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
If two big databases say that this exists and I say it doesn't, I wonder if I made it. You know, I was wrong. But at the same time, it also is a cause for confusion. If, you know, it's just like that gene, it, for some reason or the other, it's been considered reviewed by you or proposed by somebody else, and somebody else just has it deprecated, it makes you wonder why. And you can't move forward because you start to wonder, you know, am I building a house on like, crappy soil?
That's a good question. Very biblical question.
Well, that's odd of me because I'm not biblical by any means.
No, this is a really good – I think this is a really good question. You brought up a lot of challenging points that are transferable across a lot of different domains.
Don't build a house with rotten wood. That's the bottom line.
There you go. That's true. Johnny Cash built his house out of reclaimed wood, out of old barns from around America.
You're kidding.
No.
That just sounds so...
Doesn't that sound Johnny Cash?
Ridiculously American.
That sounds even, Johnny Cash.
My mind just blew up.
I know. Oh, my gosh. Johnny. I love Johnny. He's my boy. I miss him. He was a... Yeah, he had a great... He, have you, you've heard, is it the Trent Reznor song, Hurt?
Yeah.
So, Johnny covered that on one of his last albums.
Mm-hmm.
And when Trent Reznor heard it, he just looked at it and said, yeah, that's Johnny's song now. it's 100% true.
Yeah, I don't remember Trent ever singing that song, even though it must have been his song, I guess.
He wrote it, yeah, I think most people know it as Johnny's song, and when Trent heard it, he's just like, yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, he listened to it, and it just embodies the entirety of Johnny's life, and it's just, when you listen to it, you're like, how could anybody else have this, like, how could anybody else sing this and own this the way that he does?
Mm-hmm.
And did you hear... So Coldplay, their album XY, the track of the end, Till Kingdom Come.
Mm-hmm.
So they wrote that for Johnny to play with, to play with him. And then he passed away before they could record it. So they recorded it and put it on the end of their album. But that was originally for Johnny.
Wow. You know, that the whole Coldplay style is very different from Johnny's style.
I know.
I wonder what they even would have sounded like.
I don't know, but it... I mean, you can kind of that song though is very much in a Johnny Cash type of style. It's much less a Coldplay song, and that's kind of why they ended it. So I don't even think it's listed on the liner notes. It's just like track 13. If you just like hit it, maybe it is, but it's definitely distinctly not part of the album. The album ends, and then there's this last song that comes in, and it's kind of this haunting, like just acoustic vocal kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really good though.
Huh.
Yeah. So yeah, so from Reacto to Johnny Cash and Coldplay through the via Rotten Wood. Or reclaimed wood in barns.
I wonder if you can how often can you get how easy is it to get reclaimed wood? I'll ask that question. Do you know?
I think it's pretty easy to get quality reclaimed wood. So when somebody tears something down, they have to disassemble it, not just demolish it. So,
are you sure?
He's pretty sure. Otherwise, you would destroy all the beams and joints and stuff.
But what's it matter if it's going to be trashed anyway?
Well, because you can't compromise the structural integrity of the wood.
Oh, if you want it to be reclaimed.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. I don't think it's super difficult, but it has to be, whatever you're trying to get it from has to be disassembled. So it's a lot more common. So I think now that it's becoming more of a phenomena, I think people are people are starting to disassemble their, disassemble property. So when they're demolishing a barn, they'll take it apart and then sell the wood back. Or older structures that have, quality like cedar or something in them.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. I didn't know you could do that.
But most houses today, nobody cares. It's the old school ones.
Yeah, you know, I'm thinking about wood slabs now. You ever seen those slab tables, wood slab tables? Yeah. They're gorgeous.
With a little bit of warp right in the middle.
Yeah, yeah. I love those, and they're actually really cheap. In high school, I was in wood shop, and one thing I wanted to build was a table. And I never got around to doing it, but I think that's one project that I still want to do is to build a table. But now I've modified that dream for it to be a wood slab table.
Oh yeah.
So it's one of those things where it would be awesome just to have my own wood slab desk.
That one is maybe a little bit less interesting to me because I feel like if it's your desk, you want it to be smooth and flat. But whereas you want a table, like a little bit of a rough hewn kind of wood table. Those are amazing.
Well, you could always plane it, make it flat. It doesn't have
that's
to be.
True. Or what would be would be really beautiful is with a really great grain of wood with just a thin glass over it to flatten it. One, to protect the wood, and two, to flatten it out.
Mm-hmm.
And that would, you get this parallax effect or whatever. Of looking at it through a really high quality piece of glass, that'd be beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be beautiful. But no, I love big wood dining room tables and stuff like that. We had one when I was growing up. Parents still do. And, you know, it's just, it gets this character of being nicked and dinged. And you have a family of, you see a seven, family of seven.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, stuff doesn't stay in the same shape as when you bought it. And in fact, I had a, we had a family friend, they had younger kids. They bought a big, you know, wood table or whatever, and painted it black so that it would just be black already. And then gave all the kids hammers, and they gave it the distressed wood, the distressed look, and they just beat on it with hammers for an hour or two, and just gave it like gave it that really distressed, dinged up, like hammered look.
Just
they just embraced it.
Wow!
Like we have your little kids. And a family, and stuff's just going to get... If we try and keep it nice, it's not going to happen, so we're going to go full on. And it was awesome. They had this really cool, like... It just looked like this really vintage, like, antique wood table. I mean, it's black, but it looked like a...
Wow.
Vintage table.
That's, I've never heard that before. That's
I know, but I was just like, good on you. Like, embrace the limitations.
I'd be, like, the opposite person. I'd be, like, yelling at everybody and trying to keep things pristine.
Yeah, I think you just... I mean, I just don't think you can do that. You can't do that when you have, like, when you have young kids and, like, multiple young kids. Like, I think stuff just happens.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's, like, rather than going neurotic about it, you just embrace it.
Oh, that's going to be scary, man. Like, I can imagine I have, like, my computers. I have all this high tech.
I know. I have all this, like, fragile things.
And one day when I have a kid, you know, it's going to end up being, like, I have to keep them out of that room. Or, like, let them not, you know, make them not yeah. touch my stuff somehow.
With my family, we, growing up, we didn't break things very often.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not like stuff would just get, like, shattered and weirdness. But stuff would get worn really fast. And so stuff like a table where everybody's sitting and eating, stuff like that would get, like, we never had to replace a TV because we, like, broke it or... Like electronics and stuff, our cars, cake cars, cup holders would get. You'd just get wear and tear, so that would get accelerated. So whereas things that were nice that we didn't interact with would stay nice because, you know, like our computers and stuff stayed in good shape just because we didn't use them nearly as much.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more of the wear and tear, I think, as opposed to just like outright destruction.
Right. Interesting.
Yeah. Although most electronics that went into that house were the... The ghost in the machine would come out. We even have stuff that just would fail. Or just, like, never work the way that it was promised
mm-hmm.
to. I don't know how many routers I've tried to put into that house. And it's just a disaster. Just a dead zone.
You know,
partially because where we have to put the router is right under a metal, a metal ventilation shaft, which probably screws with the Wi-Fi to no end. But, yeah, just stuff would die. It would overheat, crash. Would never get the range, like... I mean, my parents' house isn't huge. It's three stories with a basement. It's not massive. And there are three access points through the house to, like, get the Wi-Fi all the way through it.
Wow.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
You know, in my
parents' house... I mean, including the router. So the router and two access points.
In my parents' house, so the Wi-Fi router in my house is in my room. All the tech stuff is in my room.
Of course.
And... For some reason, you can't get Wi-Fi in the kitchen because my room is, like, on the opposite end of the house from the kitchen.
Yeah.
So what I ended up doing was just taking my router and holding it up, like, putting it up on top of a shelf. I didn't hammer it into the wall. I just put it up higher on a shelf. And all of a sudden, I was getting Wi-Fi in the kitchen. And it was a pretty damn strong signal.
Yeah.
And it's amazing that, you know, just putting it up higher, like, what a difference it can make.
Wi-Fi, I was talking to some, like, professional network engineers a couple years ago, and they were just like, oh, Wi-Fi is the devil's band. Like, it's just magic. it'll work, or, well, it'll work one day, it'll work, and then the next day, well, it's magic. It's absolutely magic. And yeah, that's 100% true. Just like, you tweak it just there, right? So, I don't know if you had this phenomena. So, growing up, so you grew up in San Francisco. I grew up in small town Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get TV?
Oh, we just like called Comcast or whatever, and they just came in and, you know, sort of opened the cable box and like flipped the switch, and they're like, "Okay, you're good to go," and that's pretty much it.
Okay, so the Robinson family did not have cable growing up. for personal choices until we didn't get cable until I left for college. Then they got the full big DirecTV package and all that stuff. Of course they did, right? That's how families always do. But we had – so we got our TV over the air. And we have what they call the Farmer Five, right? So you get ABC, CBS, NBC, Fox, and PBS. So that was your Farmer Five.
Oh, God.
And it just – we lived in the suburbs, right? So suburbs of like a medium-sized town. So we weren't like way far out in the middle of nowhere. But every time you would want to like watch TV, it was the dance with the antenna. So to the left, up, down, got it, hold it. Oh, it's out. So to the right, and it's like you have somebody that would be holding the rabbit ears or the big, like, whatever concoction we had that week to, like, do it. And so you're just, like, trying to, like, figure
it
all out.
Why does it keep changing, though? Like, why won't it?
It's really sensitive to, like, atmospheric conditions and stuff. And stuff when you'd set it up and you'd perch it precariously. Like from like this on this little shelf, whatever, and then it just fall over, right? Because
you know,
just,
I think
it weighed itself over.
I think kids nowadays. I mean, I don't even so where I live. I do have access to cable, not just cable, but HBO Go and Showtime on campus. Yeah. They order all those packages for you, and I don't even need to be in my room to watch that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I can be on my computer downstairs or on my computer in like Gould Hall, somewhere completely far away from where I live. And I can just go to an app called Philo, and I can watch whatever I want there. Or I have Netflix or Amazon Prime or Hulu.
Yeah.
Like, I have all these options. I don't even have a TV in my house.
I have my TV because I love watching things on my TV and on my sound system and everything. But as far as watching live TV, sports. Like, that's basically all that I'll watch live.
Mm-hmm.
I download all my TV shows. I either watch it on Netflix or I watch Prime or something like that. And so the only thing I'm watching live is like the Seahawks and then maybe like the Huskies or whatever. But my sports teams. I love watching Purdue football, basketball, but you don't get it out here, so I don't even get to really watch that. So my parents have looked at several times of getting
Sling boxes,
yeah. And putting so DirecTV keeps offering us like a new DVR, so we could actually like dedicate a DVR just for the Sling box. But their bandwidth is too low. They are on like a 3 or 5. I think they're on like a 3 megabit connection.
Hmm. You know, that makes me wonder if I can get a Sling box and set it up in my apartment and then sling that like basically record Game of Thrones for myself and then watch it at a different time, because I can't record it, you know, on my computer.
Sling box, I don't think it has a coaxial input, so you would need something like a receiver or something.
Yeah, I'll look into it.
I think it only has like HDMI and like composite component in or something like that. So, but yeah, no, that would be interesting. Well, the thing about Sling box is I don't think it records stuff, right? It just streams whatever the input is.
Right, but on the other end, you can record it. You can record that stream.
That's true. The other thing would be one of those little TV dongles. The HD TV dongles are like $30 to $50 or whatever.
But how do those work? They just catch stuff off the air?
They catch whatever the input signal is, and they just have a tuner, right? So they just tune to the right channel and record. So I've actually looked at getting one of those and plugging it into my Raspberry Pi, which supposedly it works. More just for the novelty to try it out, but. I do love my Raspberry Pi though. It's pretty amazing. My little OpenELEC, so my custom compiled XBMC distribution. It works really well. And I just have like a 1.5 terabyte hard drive I've hung off the back.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got a giant collection of TV shows and stuff on there. So
cool.
Yeah.
Really cool.
Yeah, it works really well. And I can stream to it with on my phone. It sets up as a DLNA receiver. So I can like basically like AirPlay to my Raspberry Pi. So I can actually, it has an AirPlay receiver in it, so I can actually AirPlay. But then I can also do like a pseudo type from like my phone and stuff, which is, it's kind of cool. So it just sits there in the back, $35, uses basically no power. So
cool, man.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I think I kind of want to move on to a different topic here.
Okay.
I remember I think it was yesterday, the day before, I forget when. The last time you and me were in the office, we were having this conversation about different machine learning methods and, yes. and what to use for what question. Mm-hmm. So I started to kind of map out my own little table for that.
Okay.
And I have it highlighted here. I don't know if you can see much of that. But really, the columns that I want...
Doesn't look like a chart, buddy.
Well, not yet. It's it's written in text. You
okay,
know?
Yes.
But hopefully it's going to be a chart. But what I want to have is basically like the classifier or the, you know, the actual technique. And then the types of data it can handle. And then the assumptions of that model. And then the time complexity in big O time. And that should give me, or anybody using this chart, a comprehensive overview of what method to use for what question.
That looks great.
So I'm gonna,
that's could be extremely useful.
Yeah, I'm gonna try and fill that out, especially yeah. if you're. I mean, I know a lot of this stuff, but at the same time, I do forget. You know the intricate. You know the intricate mm-hmm. details of like a support vector machine or something.
Yeah.
And this is a great way to like get a big picture view of what I want to use and how I want to use it.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. This would be really great. Just a simple markdown file. Sorry, markdown file on GitHub. Do some collaboration kind of stuff would be kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I like you your idea earlier about the we're same conversation. Your idea of doing the decision flow chart of like what's my data, what question am I trying to ask, like that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
That would be something. Once you start with a basis like this, it might be kind of cool to be able to build something simple that would help walk people through.
Right, because I mean,
along with links to explanations of why you might do this.
Exactly, and the idea here is that you know you have certain types of data that you can use. So I mean, if you're in stats, if you have if your output variable is a 0 or a 1, if you have binary data,
mm-hmm.
you're going to use logistic regression off the bat.
Mm-hmm.
You won't even think twice about it, right? So just based off of the nature of your data, you're making a model decision. And that same type of mentality can apply to machine learning. You might not want to use PCA if you don't have continuous data, so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And you know exactly what you can and can't do or what your limitations are based on the nature of your data. And you won't just like force methods to work. And then when you force it to work, you get an answer. And the answer is completely wrong and misleading.
Mm-hmm.
And you know the whole point of this of machine learning and classifying and making predictions is to help drive good decision making.
Yeah.
And if it's not going to help you do that, there's no point in doing it.
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head. I think a big problem with a lot of big data machine learning stuff is that we try and find it, you naively apply an algorithm until something kind of works, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or until you get an answer you're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your confirmation bias there or whatever. And I think, yeah, I think having something to you really need to understand the underlying dynamics of your data, which is why domain knowledge is so important. You need to understand the underlying mechanisms of the algorithms. But I think it's like we've been talking about before, jumping into a new field. Some of these fields are so like well established that they're so broad already that it's almost impossible to know where to start. And I think having something to help narrow down the plane to like narrow it down to say, okay, here's one or two methods that you should look at, and here's the links to some good resources to go and like figure it out. Then for me, because I'm vaguely familiar with some of these methods, but I haven't really dug too far into them. So that enables me to say, okay, now I'm going to go look at, is a support vector machine really what I want to use? Why wouldn't I use logistic regression, right? And like going out and confirming that on my own, but at least gives me a starting point.
Right.
That I can then build off of and be able to confidently say, so when you say, Nick, why'd you use this method? I say, for X, Y, and Z.
Right. Not just because, it's kind of the cool new thing nowadays.
Yeah.
You know? And with more and more people using machine learning libraries and, you know, they become very accessible through mm-hmm. Python or through R. So
Go now. Yeah, you can do it in Go.
Right. And using them is just a matter of calling a function. You import your library, you call the function, and that's that. So I think we have a lot of people, at least over the past few weeks, I've been seeing a lot of work where it's just someone just uses a method because, hey, they can. They can just import it and run it.
Yeah.
And it's just, why are you doing this? Like, it's the wrong type of data. It's the wrong technique for the wrong question. Like, I don't see – I mean, it's cool that you built it. That's awesome, you know, but at the same time, it doesn't do us any good.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, no, I think that's really true. Absolutely.
And hopefully I can do the exact same type of chart for different types of data visualizations. So that's also
there you go.
On the
place right to your wheelhouse.
Exactly.
Awesome.
Great.
Well, moving on, we want to jump. Can we jump to the next topic here?
Yeah, let's do it.
So I found this article on Wired the other day. Actually, it was sent to me. This is just 2 days ago. So 4:30. So April 30th. It's on Wired. It's called "The Universe is Programmable." Period. We need an API for everything. And basically, this guy goes through and tells us about how we just need to understand our whole goal in life should be to figure out the API for everything.
Okay.
And then from there, being able to, control, it says API, the API may sound like just another arcane computer acronym, but it's really one of the most profound metaphors of our time. An idea hiding beneath the surface of each piece of tech we use every day, from iPhone apps to Facebook, to understand the APIs are and why they're useful. But then he goes on and starts talking about like biological systems and a way of understanding the universe and programming it and genetically modified crops and all this stuff. Oh, and then he goes on to GitHub and talks about how we need to open source everything, and that corporate conundrums are the corporate conundrum, right? That corporations have no place in the gathering of human knowledge. So Keith Axline here, he taught himself to program over the last 2 years. The experience has changed his life and what he understood life to be.
Oh, good God.
I know. So I went and looked this guy up because he was just raving about GitHub. And so I think I just would have one comment. Keith, before you loud or disloud GitHub, you should at least maybe make a commit once.
Ooh, wow. So, burn. that's a hurtful one.
Sorry. I'm being a little sorry here. So this brought up an interesting thing. One, in the fact that, like, I think that he hits on this idea of, like, of an API for everything or an SDK for all of this stuff is, one, I think, is an interesting way of looking at it and looking at how we – and it's I think, a useful abstraction for – looking at the way that we interact with and the way that we manipulate systems and concepts and stuff like that, of finding out what we're able to do and what we can't and just kind of the right buttons to push, right? I think it becomes especially potent in genomics or in physical engineering, right? Working with materials and working with chemical compounds. You could look at, instead of just looking at it from the idea of reactions and responses and electron movement, like looking at it, taking a step back and looking at it from the concept of an API, mm-hmm. I think is a really powerful metaphor. Where I think he runs into this problem is the universe is not our plaything. And I think that the way that he writes here is this very, very staunchly naturalistic, humanistic approach, which basically says we just have to, the only reason why the universe is not bent to our will is that we just haven't figured out the right code, like the right API calls yet.
Well, it's a lot of, I think he's probably in this world of, there's a lot of techniques out there. And I mean, the world that I live in is more of like, you know, APIs are kind of old news. And
that's the other thing. It's way old school.
It's not just old news, but it's giving you an access point to access something that's been built already.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of stuff that we don't understand and we don't we haven't programmed it.
Yeah.
So, you know, an API is not going to be useful to us because it's not going to be in the API to call in the first place. And lots of people spend years and years and years developing models that will be useful to others. But APIs are not the answer. I think people have even moved on from APIs to, like, you know, other types of interfaces.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure, but...
I think there's a couple ways to, so that's the other thing. It's like, operating systems and stuff are written in ABIs, application binary interfaces, which is much more low level. And basically, like, it just is like a list of the call tables and stuff that you can do. So an API is a really high level, level of abstraction. But I think you've hit on a good point of it's you're walking a map that's already been walked. I think Keith would argue that, well, the APIs already like exist in the universe, so we just have to figure them out. Kind of like how Apple, a trivial example, Apple has for like the iPhone and OS X, they have private APIs, which are just undocumented.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you know where to look or you stumble across them, it's like a whole bunch of other stuff that, because Apple builds everything on their own APIs and they just mark some as private so that you can't. So like for a long time, like the web integration APIs were private. So that way you couldn't build like Chrome or something on top of their platform. And so you just have to like kind of stumble along and find it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think you've hit on a point of saying, if like, okay, so right now we're able to do X, Y, and Z with some biological or chemical system, but we fundamentally don't understand how that's working. And I guess the idea of an API is that it's been exposed so that Apple's idea is that you do everything. Like, we want you to do all sorts of stuff with the API, and we roughly understand all the things that you can do with it. And we blocked and guarded to make sure that you're not going to hit any weird bugs or weird errors, that it's going to do what you expect it to do, and that it's got all the range of things that you want to do with it, it's going to work in that way. Right. And of course, there are limits to that, right? We file bugs all the time. But for the most part, you know that it's going to behave a certain way.
You know, and what else is that? A lot of APIs are provided by private companies.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if I heard you right, but it sounds like he may have put down a lot of companies and that they have no place in the programming world? Or is that what you said? Or
so he goes his corporate conundrum. Basically, he says we need open source, that knowledge has to go everywhere and stuff. And the ultimate goal should be to share everything. So he comes down the corporate conundrum and he said, the real trick is getting corporation governments the world to play this game. Sorry, right-wing capitalists, this is where we part ways. If we're ever able to live on Mars, geoengineer the planet, or make any other course correction to avoid gassing ourselves out of a home, there's no way we can keep big scientific breakthroughs bottled up inside of corporate or government organizations.
Or government organizations?
Yeah.
Oh, man. Okay.
Well, so what's interesting, right? He's lauding GitHub and all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
GitHub's, I'm pretty sure their core is closed source.
I know. That's what I'm thinking.
He talked like Facebook, open source. Facebook, I think, is actually, Facebook and Google, I think, are two really good models of how to do open source going forward.
But more importantly, we have APIs because they don't want to open source.
Yeah. It's right? Not just here's the code. Like, let's give you little chunks and bits and pieces of our
code. It's like, I want you to use our code, but I don't want to give you our code. So here's just an interface so you can access our code and use it in your application, but we're not going to tell it to you.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you, I mean, you can't have GitHub and APIs at the same time. It does not work that way.
So we used to, science used to be really, 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 really open. Like, people would just circulate letters to each other. The famous case in biology, the Henrietta Lacks cells, Gray, I think that's his name, at Johns Hopkins, he would just mail samples to people. Mm-hmm. If you just called him for a sample, he'd just mail it to you, right? And it used to be really open. And then it turned out that, like, we started to solve some of these problems, which required a lot of resources, a lot of effort. And so things kind of closed up. And then you had the rise of like, the laboratories, right? The couple famous ones are Bell Labs, which was in, you know, like, the 50s or whatever. Mm-hmm. And just they changed the world because they had all of these things. They did everything from, like, the way that we know, the rate at which we know that like trees decay or wood decays is because Bell planted dropped telephone poles on the ground in Howell, New Jersey, or wherever it was, Horndale, and then monitored the decay for 100 years. And like, that's part of how we figured it out, right? Because they had all these problems, these big problems that needed solved. And so they needed the talent, the engineering to do it. And some of it went out and some of it stayed closed, but has now made its way like diffused. The other one is Park with Xerox. And so some of that stuff that they did is closed source, some of it's open source, it's been diffused, like all this different stuff. So he does have some point in that open source is like just this really powerful and amazing tool for doing a lot of things. The question is, where does it fit into the modern space? And I would argue that the model going forward looks a lot less like the Linux kernel and a lot more like Google and Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense of that they are huge contributors to open source. Google is one of the heaviest contributors to like the Linux OS right now. Part of it is because they're solving really hard problems that they have, and so they have to fix it. Intel's another big, IBM is another big core Linux. They run the Apache Foundation or support it, and so there's another one. So Facebook and Google, you see them open sourcing these kind of base technologies that's like everybody could benefit from this, this is really interesting. It has nothing to do with our core business, but it's really useful. So we're going to keep open sourcing this. And you see that kind of all the pieces around their kind of core code base are open sourced, and they're contributing to, other people are contributing to, and then it's around this kind of closed source core that is also generating a lot of other interesting problems and a lot of interesting knowledge that is eventually going to get diffused out. But it's also generating innovation on its own. Like, Google came out, one of the reasons that Google did what they did is because Yahoo had patents and was protected in the way that they were searching the web. And yes, Sergey and Larry thought they had a new innovative like idea, but one of the reasons why Facebook or Google is just not just another Yahoo was because they had to go and approach it a different way.
Right.
And that in itself is a powerful mechanism for innovation and development that you can't just toss out. Because if you toss it away, you're going to lose a whole bunch of this innovative spirit of saying, like, I have to do something. I have to do it differently.
Right. Yeah, I agree with that. That's really true.
And so I think he hits on a point of, like, we really had to wrestle with this and how we do this going forward. And as scientists and people who hopefully want to be in industry and all this stuff, we have to ask these kinds of questions. And it's not an all or nothing. It's a balancing act, and I think it's going to be difficult, but it's something that we have to be working on.
And there was one thing that he mentioned in there. I mean, that line about how corporations and governments should be sharing all this stuff with lay people.
Mm-hmm.
First off, a lot of lay people won't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
Second, when they do get it, it's kind of dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you don't know how to use it, what the limitations are,
mm-hmm.
what the challenges are. It's like giving somebody a gun without teaching them how to use it.
Yeah.
Or gun safety. And in that way, that's a lot of why open source, I mean, stuff is not open source because of liability.
Yes.
Of legal liability. I mean, you can't just
release stuff to the world. On both ends. Not just, if you open source something, you can usually cover yourself from liability. But people who are using it may not be able to cover themselves from liability. They
right.
may be held accountable for it. Absolutely. So I thought it was an interesting article. I thought it was very, very provocative, which is a lot of what good writing is. I thought this article was not headed in the right direction. Generally, my response to stuff like this is, like, this reads something kind of like Peter Thiel saying, like, I'll give you $100,000 if you drop out of college because I don't think college is valuable.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I just want you to build and code, which is the same thing of back in the 70s, one of, not Saul Alinsky, but one of like the really well-known radicals was basically paying people to drop out of college and become hippies. Like, that's what he wanted people to do. And he was like helping people do that. Like, I read that same type of thing. It's like, because I think that we need, like, this type of stuff reads to me not like ignorance or malicious, but as like rank naivete.
Yeah, that's true.
And part of the reasons why we need the humanities and the social sciences is that they help check this naivete.
There's a lot of, I mean, God, even the whole statement with Peter Thiel, I didn't know he was offering people $100,000 to not go to college.
Granted, he has like bounds and rules and stuff on that. But I think in principle, that's a really terrible.
I think so, too. There's a lot of value to a degree and to going to college that you don't get from. I mean, I think what he was doing, maybe he's just thinking of it strictly speaking in terms of, like, how useful it is in terms of, like, if you want to code, you don't need to go to school for 4 years to learn how to code. That's true, but you miss out on a network of people
mm-hmm.
that are going to be helpful. You miss out on a lot of cool experiences
mm-hmm.
and being able to explore yourself and understand yourself. You miss out on a whole bunch of job opportunities. You miss out on a whole bunch of of other interesting things. And whether it's worth $100,000, that's, I think, very subjective.
I think so too. And the idea is that you go and do your own startup and all this kind of stuff. But the other thing that I think that breeds is it breeds flat people.
Oh, totally.
It breeds people who, I'm really good at programming or I'm really good at machine learning or something, so I'm going to go out and do that.
And they know nothing about anything else.
Yeah, and maybe they think, well, I'll just read a book and like pick. And it's totally not, you know, like there's so much more of a didactic portion of learning that exists beyond. I read lots of books, but the value of that is then I discuss them with like you and my other friends. And mm-hmm. So yes, I'm reading those books, but then I'm engaging with other people who are intelligent, well-read, and like and thoughtful, and we're building that core knowledge set. And if I live in a world in which everybody else is like me and doesn't have that background, I mean, I have groups of friends that don't have that background, and I have no ability to like to internalize and process the knowledge that I'm generating.
You know, I actually met a friend. I had a beer with a friend last night, and it was a guy I knew in high school, and he is a pretty smart statistician. And he was talking about how he wants to learn Java. And I was telling him, you don't want to learn Java. Like, forget the Java. You don't need Java. Coding is easy. Anybody can code. I was coding at 12.
Yeah.
Like, coding is not hard. And yes, you don't need to go to college to code. But what you do get in college, what you do get, you know, in a stats program, is learning the intricacies of these algorithms. Because the implementation, yes, it's important to do it efficiently. But the actual, you know, understanding what an algorithm is doing, what the assumptions are, what the limitations are, how you can use it, how you can maybe be creative with it, how you can't use it. Those are all really important details that the folks who just learn how to code are not going to know. They're going to be code monkeys, so to speak. You know, you just, yes, you can learn how to code, but after, you know, and but you can't do your own startup. I don't know how you can do your own startup without knowing anything but how to code.
Yeah. Well, I think we see that it doesn't work.
In fact, I've known a lot of startup founders who don't know how to code at all.
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. I think – so learning to code is like learning how to use a saw.
Basically.
It's a tool. Or a tool – you call it toolkits, right? It's like learning to use a toolbox. It's like – I don't know. When you moved out to your first apartment, did your parents get you like a beginning apartment kit?
Nope.
Yeah. Mine didn't either. But I built one before I moved out here. And I have some friends that like you can buy them, right? It's like a basic set of tools, a basic set of like accessories that you'll need to like maintain an apartment, and it has a booklet on like how to do simple things like fix a radiator or something, or like change light bulbs, retrue a door, hang photos, like pictures, like that kind of like simple type of stuff. That's what programming is, right? And it's like maybe you get a little bit of like the background, but constructing, you're talking about creating wood slab tables. There's so much more that goes into that is not just using a saw and cutting the wood.
Exactly. I mean, you'd have one shoddy table if you just did that.
Yeah. And so you're right. So programming, there's so much more that goes into development, that goes into creation, the creation of something that is beyond just the tool. That's why. Like really, really good programmers or really, really good developers who have an idea of like the ecosystem and everything. If you ask them like what they're coding in, they're just like usually you get like a really ambivalent response.
And this is what makes me feel like folks like Peter Thiel. I mean, I wonder if he's going to. I bet you his terms are that he has to be an advisor to the startup or whatever. So basically, all he's doing is he's just buying cheap labor. He's just saying, hey, we're going to have somebody who can't quit because they have no degree. I'm going to pay you $100,000 so you can't say no. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, you're going to do what I want you to do and build my startup, and you're going to code it. And if we take off and do great, then awesome. If not, then, well, you didn't waste your time because doing this was smarter than going to college. But that's his own opinion, which he forced on some young, naive person who wants to be the next Sergey Brin. He's basically preying.
And he's never seen $100,000 in their life before. Right.
Like, so yeah. He's preying on people who want, like, on people's ambitions and dreams. It's like.
I think he has his, you know, we all have our idealized states and our idealized worlds. And he has his, and I would say less praying. I would go more on the grounds of naivete, of saying that, like, he desperately wants people to be happy and I'm going to idealize it here. It's just easier to work in like and work in an idealized, like an ideal situation. So an ideal situation, he wants people to experience the life that he has and to be happy and fulfilled. And he's seen people be burned by education. So he's like, just come out and go do it. Because that's what he did, right? And so he wants people to walk the path that he's walked, which has led him to success. That's a marvelous, that's a compassionate way to approach with people. And I think it's the way that I think if we're happy with our life that we should have, it's a natural extension to want that for other people. And that's a good and a positive thing. Where it runs into problems is when you start to like nuance all of that view and like, this may not be the best. And college is not the best option for everybody. Like there are lots of people who it's not going to, but I have several friends who didn't go to college that are happy, fulfilled, successful, innovative, like all of the things that you would want people to be like, they are right now. Mm-hmm. And so it's not the ideal for everybody, but my default state is in general, like go to college, do that kind of stuff. The other thing that's dangerous about this view is that when we take a step back and we look at like our society as a whole, like liberal democracy, and here using liberal in the classical sense of like free democracy,
mm-hmm.
requires like values and truths and ideals to function. But it can't generate it on its own. It doesn't just create goodness and happiness and all of this stuff on its own. Those have to come from the people and from within. And they have to be generated by the populace, right? It's all about express preferences, right? But we have to have preferences to express. And then we have to have some idea of what are better preferences than others, right? There are lots of things that I would like to do in my life that are fairly worthless. Like, and so part of it is I'm filtering the preferences that I should be expressing and working towards them. And that requires a people to be able to understand that and to have those values and to hold those in high regard. And so the question is then what we're doing conducive towards that, which is essence what we're doing should enter the bar, or is what we're doing contributing to human flourishing? And I think that things like that moving people away from an education system that has for thousands of years said our job is to create like whole functioning human beings. And you could argue that we're moving away from that in a lot of ways, which is why I think, again, we need a case where we need more of the humanities. But to pull people out of that system at all and to take them away from a system that's designed to not only teach you but challenge you and like mold you and saying, we're going to drop you into the world, we're going to drop you into a startup where for all intents and purposes you are a god, that's dangerous to do with an 18 or 21-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not conducive towards, I would argue, it's very difficult to make that. That as a whole is not conducive towards human flourishing.
Yeah,
and
that's
dangerous. I think it's dangerous for society to do that. Not that there aren't going to be like exceptions and where people do well and do good stuff, but it's a dangerous place. It's a dangerous precedent to set.
Totally. And I think with myself, I mean, that when I was 20, I was working for a startup company that ended up going really big, really, really big. And I was on top of the world. Like I can't tell you the at the height of my arrogance, like how cool I thought I was.
Oh yeah.
Right. But over the years, I've learned to be a lot more humble about that. And even now, like at the age of 25, I don't think it's a big deal anymore. I think it's like, oh, well, great. I mean, what's so special about what happened to me? I'm not like a superhero, and it doesn't make me smart. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, when I read this article, I think that's a really good reflection. I appreciate that. When I read this article, I texted a friend. He sent it to me. I said, "This makes me miss the humility of genius." Of that, when you read the stories of these intellectual giants, and not all of them. Again, this is one story that has caveats and holes and stuff, but when they arrived at, kind of, especially looking back over the end of their life and the end of the career, they understood this sort of like, there's this humility of being forced to reckon with the world and the universe and nature and realizing that it was still there, it's still in charge. And there was this sort of this humility of both what they knew and what they didn't know. P.B. Medawar, the guy who did the British biologist who did, basically like the father of immunology, I think. Like he had a very humble outlook, and his like last book was called The Threat and the Glory, I think, yeah, which was about the benefits and the challenges of the scientific progress. And in this article, I was missing that. And as much as I am an optimist and believe and excited when I read other pieces of optimistic outlook, it doesn't mean that we get to be unreflective or uncritical about it. And it doesn't mean that we get to look at it and say, look what we can do. We also have to look at it and say, oh my gosh, look how much else there is out there.
Very well said.
Thank you. Rant, you know, bracket and rant.
You know, I think we should just end it there. Like that was a good stopping point, if you ask me.
All right. I'll do that. We're right at an hour, so we're right on time.
Okay.
And I see you're adding a few other things on there. Good. So that means we'll have a good show next time. So I was a little bit nervous. We were almost at the end of our stuff, the list of things to talk about, and then we filled the space.
Yep. Okay, guys. Well, thank you for listening. You can contact me at Nikhil Gopal, or you can contact Nick at Nick Robison on Twitter. And you can get both of us at @informatanauts.
All right, guys. Well, thank you very much for listening, and we will see you next week.
Have a good one.